Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Patitamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Yaeko vipati svatav shuddha chetaha. Yaeko vipati svatav shuddha chetaha. Prakasha swarupo pinane vatishu. Prakasha swarupi nane vatishu. Shuravo dakasto yatapanurekaha. Shuravo dakasto yatapanurekaha. Sanityo palabdi surupo hamatma. Sanityo palabdi surupo hamatma. Sandhi. Yaha ekaha vipati swataha shuddha chetaha. Prakasha swarupaha api nana Iva Dishu. Sharava Udaka Staha Yata Bhanuhu Ekaha. Saha Nitya Upalabdhi Swarupaha Aham Atma. Aham Atma. I am that self, right? Aham Atma. I am the self that. Saha. I am the self that. That one who is Nitya Upalabdhi Swarupaha. Whose Swarupa, whose nature, right? Every sentence, every verse ends in this, remember that. Aham Atma. I am that self whose Swarupa, whose nature is Nitya Upalabdhi. Nitya. Free from time, free from past, present, and future. Past, present, and future. So that means as it is now, always is. And what as it is now, always is? Upalabdhi, that consciousness, consciousness, awareness. So I am that conscious being. I am that conscious being which is free from time. Nitya means, doesn't really translate well as eternal when we're using it in reference to the Atma. Because eternal gives you a sense of something ongoing. Because eternally present, ongoing, changing. When you think of nitya, you should think of timeless. That which is not bound by time. So that would mean that if I say, I am, this being, the being that I am, is nitya upalabdhi. My swarupa, my nature, is the conscious being, which is free from any change. Free from change. Free from time. So as I am now, I always have been, always will be. No past, present, or future. So Hastamalika says, that's who I am. That self, which is changeless. Then he says, Yaha ekaha vibhati swataha shuddha chetaha. That one who is ekaha. Yaha means who? Yaha ekaha, one. That self, which is one. And that one, one alone, we'll see. That self which is one, that vipati swataha, it shines of its own accord. It itself shines. It itself shines without being illumined by another. An example he's going to use is just as the sun shines of its own accord, not needing to be illumined by another's sun, this atma shines vipati in its own way, right? Vipati means it shines, but vipati, in terms of vishesha, it has a particular way of shining. The particular way of shining is swataha. It is self-shining. Sometimes we use swaprakashatvam, that which is self-luminous. Swatasiddha, that which is self-evident. When we say self-luminous, self-evident, it means nothing else is lighting it up. So this conscious being that I am, which is nitya, is something which is not illumined by another, by any other, means not illumined by my mind, not illumined by my body, not illumined by an inner self or an external self, some inner being or external being. It is its own consciousness. Consciousness is consciousness because it's consciousness, right? You can say consciousness is conscious of itself, not as any type of an activity, but because it's consciousness. Sometimes we get into trouble if you say, well, consciousness is conscious of itself. So here's the consciousness. It's conscious of itself. Somehow it's looking at itself, so it's doing something to be conscious of itself. No. Consciousness, which is timeless and free from change, is self-luminous because it is consciousness. Consciousness by its swarupa, by its very nature, is self-luminous. When we translate into what do we mean by that, if, as Hastam Malika says, if this ahamatma, I am the self, which is nitya upalabdhi, which is changeless consciousness, and that consciousness shines of its own accord. That consciousness is one alone, and that consciousness shines of its own accord. He says, for who? So he says, svatta siddhaha, shuddha chetaha. Shines for who? For the one whose mind is pure. We'll see what that means in a minute. That's literally what it says. Svatta chetaha. For the one whose mind is pure, free from raga dveshas, adhikari, qualified student, ready to gain this knowledge. Okay. Say the mumukshu, who wants to gain this knowledge, whose mind is free of raga dvesha, means whose mind is prepared to recognize the self. The mind who's prepared to gain this knowledge. That's what we mean by shuddha chetaha. For this one, for this person, this self, which is one, shines of its own accord. Okay, so we'll get back to that. Okay, svatta shuddha chetaha, prakasha swarupaha api. Even though it's swarupa, prakasha swarupaha. Prakasha means luminous, consciousness. This swarupa is luminosity itself, and is ekaha, prakasha swarupaha. Even though it is self-luminous, prakasha's nature is prakasha, nana iva dishu. This awareness, this self-luminous consciousness, nana iva dishu, in the buddhis, in the intellects, in the minds, it shines as though many. Nana means many and varied. Right? Nana iva, as though it is many. So this consciousness, me, the ahamatma, which is ekaha, which is its own luminosity, which shines of its own accord, this consciousness, which is one alone, appears as though, it shines as though many, it appears as though many, where? Nana iva dishu. In all of the intellects, like in this room, say there's 20 of us. So 20 intellects, 20 minds. Each mind says, I am, I am, I am, I am, I am, I am. So the Atma, which is only one, which is simply pure consciousness, which is changeless and timeless, appears as though many from the standpoint of the 20 intellects in this room. Okay? Each one identifying, each intellect, each mind, each person, identifying with that consciousness as I am. Right? So just think about what that means. If I say right now, I am a conscious being, am I talking about the changeless Swarupa Atma, the changeless Atma, which is pure consciousness and one without a second? I don't think so. Unless I'm teaching it, right? If I say I'm a conscious being, I mean me, my mind. My mind, my sense organs, the upadi, this conditioning adjunct, the body, mind, sense organs. I'm a conscious being. Right? So the Atma, myself, is then reflected in the buddhi, in the intellect, reflected in the sense, in this sense. It's not that there's a separate consciousness being reflected in the intellect, but we say reflected in the intellect in this sense, that the intellect becomes an upadhi, a conditioning adjunct, that allows me, that allows for the experience of an identification. In other words, the buddhi allows for an experience which allows me to say, I am that. So the buddhi, which is not away from consciousness, you can never say that your buddhi is away from consciousness, or your body is away from consciousness, or your perceptions are away from consciousness. That's because everything is known to you. You're aware of it. So we talk like that, even as samsaris, even without knowledge. But the buddhi says, your intellect says, I am the conscious being, identifying consciousness with itself. When the buddhi, the thought, the mind, identifies consciousness with itself, consciousness becomes nana eva, as though many. Right? Because it is as though many. There's 20 of us in the room, and we can 20 people saying, I am consciousness. It's as though become many. Okay? So here it says, prakashasrupaha api, even though the nature of yourself is consciousness, you would never say that you are inert, right? Or that you're insentient, or that you're not conscious. You would never label your being as, oh, I'm inert. We're misusing the word then. So you recognize your own self as a conscious being. Even though that is true, nevertheless, the buddhi identifies with it, the buddhi which itself is not conscious, but is, in this sense, the buddhi itself, which is not conscious, rather it is illumined by consciousness. Why do I say that? The buddhi is not conscious. So let me make that clear for a minute. If I divide my own inner experience, right, just my inner experience, into me, the subject, and everything else. I divide everything, so me, the subject, everything else. Just for starters. The everything else is going to be whatever can be objectified. Right? Subject-object relationship. Whatever can be objectified. Objectified by what? Inertness. Inertness doesn't objectify anything. Inertness is inert. Insentiency, no. Insentiency doesn't objectify anything. So another way of saying it, there is consciousness, the conscious being, and then there is that which is illumined by consciousness. That which is illumined by consciousness comes and goes in consciousness. For instance, every thought you have in your buddhi, every thought in the mind, is illumined by consciousness. But every buddhi, every thought, every vritti comes and goes. Right? It's a thought, thought, thought. Every vritti, thought modification, is objectifiable and describable, right? And can be differentiated from another thought modification. Not only that, every thought modification has parts within itself and is subject to continual change, right? The Atma, the self that's illumining it, doesn't have any of those characteristics at all, right? Consciousness simply, the awareful being which allows these vrittis to shine, remains constant. Okay? The vrittis go on changing. The vritti go on coming and going. They're anitya. Nitya means free from time. Nitya means bound by time. The vrittis go on changing. Consciousness doesn't change. Right? The subject doesn't change. The one that illumines all experience remains constant, whereas all experience goes on changing. You can say it like that, right? The one that illumines all experience goes on changing. The one that illumines all experience remains the same, while all of the experiences go on changing. Okay, so now, svaprakasha svarupaha api, even though your being is svaprakasha, it's prakasha, it's consciousness, right? It's not an object. It's always the subject. If it's a non-objectifiable subject, not because it's consciousness. How are you going to objectify consciousness? Think about it. What is going to objectify consciousness to make it into an object? Unconsciousness? Inertness? What could possibly objectify consciousness? Consciousness behind consciousness? And then what's between the consciousness and the consciousness? Consciousness behind the consciousness, behind the consciousness, behind the consciousness. There's nothing in between for there to be any dwaita or duality there. So consciousness, the conscious being that you are, is not something that you can objectify. Nor does it have any parts that you can make it change, because what are those parts? Are those parts conscious or unconscious? If they're unconscious, they're objectified, they're not you. So consciousness itself, the prakasha, is not objectifiable. And yet, that which is objectified identifies with it and says, I am the conscious being. Those experiences that you have, especially the mind, the buddhi, right, which is objectified, identifies with the consciousness and says, I am the consciousness. Well, there's 20 in the room. 20 of us are doing that. And so now, nana eva, we have as though 20 consciousnesses. Not in reality. In reality, the one consciousness that you are, that is your own swarupa, your own nature, your own self-being, your own self-experience, not as an object, but just as you. Swaprakashatvam, the very being that you are. Right? That being can't be two. It can't be two consciousnesses. Because what's going to divide them to make them be two? What's going to be in between? You know, consciousness and matter don't go together. You know, consciousness illumines matter. Right? They're not the same order. They're not in the same order of reality. And so then again, also, this consciousness that is illumining what we call matter initially anyway, that which can be objectified, right? If you think of your experience, there is nothing in your experience that is not changing other than consciousness itself. That alone, should be enough for you to be able to differentiate the changeless from the changing. If everything that you are not, everything that you illumine changes by its nature, being bound by time and space, if that's the fact, then there's going to be, in your experience, your being, which is consciousness, and everything that changes. For everything that changes comes and goes. If it goes, it's gone. You're still here. That's the end of it. If something can go and you remain, then that's not you. Any experience that can go and you remain, that experience is not you. The most we can say, because of Advaita, non-duality, in the end, these experiences that are not you, the only reason we can say one without a second, non-dual, is that these experiences that are not you have no being apart from you. They have no being of their own. So we'll get to that later. That's how we get to Advaita, just for some of you who have that and are starting to think, well, what do you mean Advaita then? You know, if I say all of these experiences, everything that you experience that changes is not you, then there's two. Even if there's only one self that's illumining all these things that don't change, right? There's still these things that change. So then we should have me and all of these things that change. So what are we going to do with all these things that change? Yeah. Let me just tell you something that is very, very interesting. Even in your experience right now, in fact, one was telling me that her little son, when he was a young boy, had asked his mother this, something like this. I don't remember exactly the words, but, Mommy, where did the prior moment go? Where did the last minute go? Where is it? Isn't that interesting? This is a whole unfold, Vedantic unfoldment. If you take this moment right here, here we are. Where did the last moment go? And where's the future moment? Yeah. If we think of a moment as the marking of change, okay, a moment as the marking of change, and we want to kind of these are exercises we use in trying to understand the reality of this creation that we experience. So if you think just at this moment, right, what happened to the last moment? It's not here. Whatever the condition of the last moment was is no longer, and the future moment is not here. And so when Swamiji starts doing an unfoldment like this, then he'll bring up the rose petals. It's a beautiful example from India. When they do pujas, there's all kinds of rose petals. If you were to stack some rose petals side by side by side, say you have a stack this thick, maybe there's 500 rose petals there. And if you take a needle and go like this, within an instant, the needle has penetrated those rose petals one by one. So what you think is an instant is actually 500 instances. Okay? And then if you were to blow up that rose petal, you would see the needle slowly penetrating, you know, from the right side to the left side. And as long as there is time, right? As long as there's the marking of change, no matter how infinitesimal, as long as there is time, there goes the needle, right? Marking change. And so to try to find a moment here in this creation is not really possible. You have to get to the timeless to find a moment. In fact, we will say you are the moment. You are the only moment, you in the sense that you, your being, is the presence in which these infinitely divisible moments that we experience take place. This is when we're trying to find some reality here. But that's when we go into analyzing the reality of this world that we experience as other. For now, I want you just to notice that you are here, the constant, awareful being, the me, your own presence. You are here as the constant, and whatever your experience may be, whatever your thought may be, say you have a happy thought or a sad thought or an agitated thought or just a daydreaming thought or you're thinking about something, whatever, or you're perceiving something, whatever the thought flow happens to be, happy, sad, agitated, makes no difference, whatever it happens to be, from the most sublime bliss to the most devastating sorrow. This thought flow that is passing through, changing, 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 passes through you in a sense. You're not leaving. You're not passing through. You're the constant being. The constant being that is there as the very substrate reality, the very consciousness that the thoughts enjoy. And there's that being doesn't come and go. That being shines of its own accord. That vibhati swataha, it swayam, it shines of its own accord, and it is continually present as the very being, the very me, which illumines and is the self of all of the vrittis. It is the me that illumines and is the very being, the very self of all of the vrittis. That's what all of the thought modifications. That's why I can continually say, I am happy, I am sad, I am agitated, I am this, I am that, I was happy, now I'm sad, I remains the same. The experiences that I identify with continually change. Right? And since the experiences that I'm identifying with, these changing experiences, these experiences, by the mere fact that they can change, they are limited and they exist within time. And so these experiences that are taking place in the flow of my mind are different than the experiences taking place in the flow of your mind. And so therefore, not only am I sometimes this way and sometimes that way and sometimes that way, I'm also different from you and different from you and different from you, and I'm different from the rug and I'm different from the computer and different from the table, I'm different from everything that I experience. Because once you identify with something that is an object within the creation, like the mind, you are different from everything that is not that. And you are different, and you're, when you have one thought, a happy thought, now you are a happy person. When you have a sad thought, now you are a sad person because you're identified with the mind. And whether you're a happy person or a sad person, you're different than this happy person or this sad person. Right? And you're also different from the rug. So this nana eva, we have a manifestation of duality, right? And everything is different from everything else, and every person is different from everything else. So in fact, the Atma shines variously. It shines variously in many, many ways, not only as I, but this I which is non-objectifiable, the conscious being that is non-objectifiable, actually becomes identified with many things. Let's just stick with the individual now. But this one self that is non-objectifiable, once it becomes identified with one mind, it becomes different from everything else. And so then it becomes various. Because each one of us says, I am a person. I am a conscious being. I am a self. Right? If we each say, I am a conscious being, consciousness has become manifold. You really see that? And the reason it's become manifold is because I identify with something I'm looking at. Yeah. Impossible. Like what Shankara says in his Adyasa Bhasha, of course this is ridiculous, it's not possible. However, from beginninglessness, it's in a beginningless time, this is the situation. It's a beginningless ignorance, natural to the condition of being a human being, natural to the creation. So yeah, it's impossible. It's impossible to look at something, watch it come and go, and take yourself to be that. You know, just like it's there, he uses an example, it's impossible to confuse night and day. How can you possibly confuse subject and object? The one who's the conscious being and the one that which is illumined. How can that be? Good question. But that's what we call a naughty beginningless ignorance. And because it's beginningless ignorance, because it's ignorance, that ignorance can be removed by knowledge. That ignorance, as long as it's there, it causes a lot of problems. Because a being which is limitless and actually the whole, me, is taken to be limited, subject to death, and walking around searching for yourself. It's like your life experience is more or less like beating your head against the wall. It doesn't work, okay? It doesn't work because it's not who you are. And so we're behaving in the world in a way that is absolutely the opposite of how things actually work. And so, of course, that doesn't work very well. It gives temporary illusions of working, like little moments of happiness, moments of joy. But the terrible problem is that that's exactly what they are, little moments of happiness and moments of joy, when I'm seeking to be a whole and complete being free from fear, where I can rest and relax and say, I've done all that there is to be done. All is well with me. Not all is well with me for the next 5 minutes. All is well with me, period. So now he says this nana eva dishu, the atma, which is its own light, you know, is taken as many. I'll get back to shuddha chetaha a little later. He gives an example. Yata, just as Bhanuhu ekaha, just as the sun, Bhanu means sun, the Bhanu is, the sun is one, Sharava utaka staha, the sun, which is one, is abiding there in bowls of water. Sharava means a bowl, utaka water. So in the water in bowls, so you have a whole bunch of bowls filled with water. There the sun is, the one sun is shining, reflecting in all of those bowls of water. Like that, the one Atma is reflecting in all of the bowls of the mind. Right? So he says, Sharava, Sharava, the bowl, Udaka, water, Staha, they're abiding there. Yata, Bhanuhu, Eka, just as the one, the sun which is one and luminous, right? The sun which is one and luminous, just as it is only one, can abide and reflect in many bowls of water. Like that, the Atma, the self, which is consciousness, right, is reflecting in many, many minds. The only thing we have to watch out for with the sun example, that's a powerful example, because the sun, you know, just the sun is luminous. This word prakasha means to shine. So we use this shining as a word for the Atma, for a word for Chaitanya. Consciousness shines. It's self-luminous. It's like that the sun is self-luminous. The sun illumines whatever comes into its sphere. If what is coming into its sphere happens to reflect it, be a reflecting medium, right, like water or a mirror, for instance, any reflecting medium, then not only is that reflecting medium, like the water or a mirror, illumined, right? Because just think of it, here the sun is illumining bowls of water. It's illumining the bowl, which doesn't reflect it. It's illumining the water, which does reflect it. It's illumining the grass, which doesn't reflect it. So it illumines everything that is there. But some of the things that it illumines, everything in its vicinity is illumined, it is lit up because of the light of the sun, but only some of those things reflect it. And those bowls of water, you can imagine, each little bowl of water, the water is saying, I am the sun. I am prakasha. I am a light. I enjoy the light. I am the light. I am the light. I am the light. Right? Because that reflecting medium enjoys it, enjoys the light. It has as though it reflected light, you could say. The difference, the problem is, with the illustration, is the sun's up there and the bowl's down here. Right? So we think, well, just like the sun reflecting in bowls of water, the Atma, you know, a little sun globe Atma, right, the one globe of an Atma is illumining this creation distant from it. There's no such distance. There's no such spatial distance. Right? There's not any spatial distance. You can't say that the conscious being that you are, your own presence, is away from your mind. There's no awareness in the mind here. What's in between then? You know? There's no globe of awareness, right? However, there's distance in terms of quality, right? There's a way, this way, there's a way for you, this type of distance in quotes, there's a way for you to differentiate the subject, the non-objectifiable consciousness, from the changing object of the mind, which it illumines. Pervasive to it, your being is not other than it, not away from it, right? At the same time, it's other than, in the sense that your being is changeless and the mind moves. Your being is changeless, the mind's not changeless. Your being is consciousness. The mind is illumined. Your being is the illuminer. The mind is the illumined. So there's no distance. There's not Atma over here shining down upon your mind. But there's one Atma, right, which is differentiated by nature from these objects that are coming and going. One Atma which is non-objectifiable. Many things that are objectifiable. Now, what does it mean now? When we say then, one Atma, which is non-objectifiable in many things that are objectifiable. What does it mean for you to say, or for me to say, that there is one Atma, one me, that is non-objectifiable, and then all of these things that come and go? One Atma means that the Atma that I am, that is non-objectifiable, is the only one there is. And I'm sorry for the rest of you. One Atma means there is one Atma, one self experience, one me experience. By me experience, now I'm talking about the Swaprakashatvam of the self, which is your self experience, right? Not as an object, but just as your very being, right? This being, which is the consciousness that illumines this mind and this mind and this mind and this mind and this mind. The non-atvam, that the as though being different, comes from the mind, not from the mind that labels the me, not from the me, right? So your mind says, I am. It owns me. Your mind says, I am the me. It's owning me. Your mind says it. Your mind says it. Your mind says it. But the me experience, the Swaprakashatvam, which is the self that is being owned by all of these reflecting entities, is only one. It's not that these various minds enjoy a me experience. The minds don't enjoy the me experience. The me experience, the Swaprakashatvam of the Atma, is its experience. What gives you the self experience that you are has nothing to do with the mind. It has only to do with you. Not these things that come in and go in. Just think about it. A thought comes and goes. The me experience, the Swaprakashatvam, the conscious being of yourself, doesn't come and go at all. The mind, if you think that the mind is giving you the sense of self that you have, contributing to it in some way, then what happens? You would be get just kind of ripped every time the thought goes. Right? So it actually is not aiding in any way to your sense of self. But that means that the sense of self, the consciousness that you are, which when I say the me experience, I'm talking about the Chaitanya, just the consciousness itself, that is not being contributed to by this mind or 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 by any mind. And so when every one of these minds says, I am, I am, I am, I am, it is labeling the one me experience. So 20 minds are labeling one me experience, and I am that me experience. But when I say I am that me experience, I'm talking for the one me, which is the one me that is the one me that we all are. There's not we all are. The one me that I am, and that the I that each one of us uses is labeling the me experience, the Chaitanya, which is only one. To really maybe understand this even more clearly, the dream illustration, the dream Drishtanta, is really useful, because you can understand when you have a dream at night, there can be many characters in the dream. And there can be many things, so many bowls of water in the dream, right? Many minds in the dream, but also many objects that don't reflect consciousness, but are just illumined, right? Just like in this room, there's minds in this room, there's also a rug and a table and so many things. Well, in a dream also, that's the case. But the whole dream is something that comes from you, right? So actually the whole dream is, in a sense, you can say, a projection of consciousness, right? It comes from you, is sustained by you, and resolves into you. But when that dream is there, say there are 20 people in the room, right, in the dream room, and each one of those 20 people says, I am the conscious being, I am the conscious being, I am a conscious being, and they talk to each other, and they all enjoy separate consciousnesses. Well, they enjoy separate consciousnesses only from the standpoint of the different minds and the different bodies, not from the standpoint of consciousness. That's why when you wake up from the dream, right, even though all of those, say, 20 people in the dream disappear, and whole dream universe disappears, the me factor, the being, doesn't disappear at all. Absolutely nothing happens. That's what we mean by nityam. Free from change, free from time. Your being is free from time. We can understand the mityatva, or the dependent relationship that the dream world has on the self, much easier than we can understand the mityatva, the dependent relationship that this world of experience has on the self. But when you analyze it, just like in the dream, all of your minds, and this mind, all minds, all experience is something that is known, is illumined. Right? In other words, another way of looking at it, your body, each one of our bodies, is part of this creation. Just like in the dream, each body, each dream body is part of the dream creation. Right? We don't have a problem with that. It's not like when you wake up from the dream, a few of the bodies remain. When you wake up from the dream, everything in that dream is resolved. Right? All the dream characters, the dream earth, the dream trees, everything. The dream space, the whole thing is resolved. And so that means everything in that dream belongs to it. So like that in this room. Everything in this room, in this universe, belongs to the universe, belongs to the creation. Everything objectifiable, right? So all of these bodies belong to Ishvara, belong to the creation. All of our sense organs belong to the creation. They're within duality. All of our thoughts belong to the creation. They're within duality. They're objectifiable. All of our feelings, all of our emotions, even the I thought, space itself, space, air, fire, water, earth, every single thing that can be objectified belongs to the creation. What doesn't belong to the creation as an object within it? That which cannot be objectified. That which is free from time, free from objectification. Otherwise, it's an object in the creation. It'll just go when the creation goes. It'll change as the creation changes. So who is that one? It can only be myself. So he says here, Aham Atma, I am the self whose swarupa is nitya upalabdhi. It's consciousness which is free from change. The consciousness which is one alone, ekaha. That vibhati swataha itself, it shines of its own accord. The conscious being that shines of its own accord. Nothing is illumining it. And this conscious being, even though being consciousness, being self-precocious, nature being luminosity, consciousness, it appears as though many, why? Because of all of the buddhis, all of the minds which are objects of consciousness. But because of that self-ignorance, right? If the self-ignorance wasn't there, it wouldn't be a problem. But as long as the self-ignorance is there, those buddhis say, I am that. So this consciousness, which is one without a second, which is ekaha, one without a second in consciousness, this consciousness is recognized by who? The shuddha chetaha, those whose mind, bahuvrihi, those whose mind is shuddha, means pure, free from raga dvesha. So that mind that becomes available, right, for the recognition, for self-recognition. Now, that mind becomes available for what? To recognize, if taught, with it, you need the pramana, but to recognize the self, which is its own light. The mind is now not in the way. The mind is available, but what is it available for? It's available for recognizing the freedom of my own being. The one for recognizing the one that illumines it. Does it recognize it as a knower? Does the mind recognize it as a knower? No. It recognizes it. Depends on what you mean by that, but let me give my no answer first. The mind itself doesn't have a second consciousness apart from the consciousness that illumines it. There's no second consciousness there, as though the mind has its own consciousness to now know the conscious being that illumines it. No, there's no second consciousness. There's only one consciousness. So the problem on the part of the mind has not to do with knowing consciousness like I would know that painting, right, which is away from me, and so I have to use my means of knowledge to gain a knowledge of something away from me. Here, the mind has got to recognize, differentiate me, the consciousness that illumines it, from itself. The mind, because of ignorance, has made a mistake. This is where Adyasa comes in. The mind itself has made a mistake. It has said, I am the consciousness. And therefore, I, the consciousness, am always changing. I, the consciousness, am sometimes sad. I am the consciousness who is sometimes happy. This is the mistake that the mind has made. Knowledge releases it from that mistake, where the mind self recognizes itself as the mind, which is illumined, which enjoys consciousness but doesn't own it. The mind recognizes that because consciousness, my own presence, is self-evident, self-effulgent. The mind doesn't light it up, but it is able to recognize that its nature is that of the illumined, not the consciousness that illumines it. And so really it's a question here of removing the ignorance. It's what we call ajnana nivritti. The ignorance has to be removed from the mind. It's not as though the mind has to gain knowledge. Gain knowledge means there's something to know that's away from it. It can't. It can't gain knowledge. It can only have the ignorance removed from itself, which has caused it to make this superimposition. It's caused the mind to say, I am the self, rather than recognizing that it by nature is the illumined one and the self is constant. So what does this mean? It means in your experience, now, right now, you know, your being that shines as you, no matter what the thought, no matter what the feeling, no matter what the mood, you are the one that illumines it, and that one is changeless and non-objectifiable. Being changeless and non-objectifiable, that one is one alone. One alone, meaning the one, same one in all beings, one in all beings. So this is that verse, then goes on. Every one of these verses is trying to really give the vision that there is only one Atma, that your being is one without a second, and its nature is Nitya Swarupa, Nitya Upalabdhi. Swarupa means nature. Now, one other thing on this. When we use words like Upalabdhi or consciousness or awareness or self-experience or me, I like to use the word me, okay? Whatever the word, there is no object out here, consciousness. Right, like if I say the word lamp, there's an object out here. So we can all look, oh, this is a lamp, and I can give you the characteristics of a lamp, something that gives off light and whatnot, lights a room, you know, a table, something that we can write on. We can describe it. It's an object. There is no such object, consciousness, because consciousness is non-objectifiable. It's not something that you can look at or that you can hear with your ears or that you can perceive through your sense organs. The only one that can know what consciousness is you, because you are that consciousness. So what this means is that when we use a word like consciousness or awareness, you know, and that's why when we use a word like consciousness or awareness, we have to do these teaching methodologies of differentiating the seer from the seen and all of these teaching methodologies, so that the word consciousness can land on the consciousness that you are. Right? Because there's no object out here. So then you can say, if we say you are conscious, then you would say, yes, I am a conscious being. That's right. I'm a conscious being. Right? Because we know what consciousness is in terms of inertness. And I would say, yes, I'm a conscious being. But then if I were to ask you, well, what is that consciousness that you are? And then the mind probably just kind of dries up right there. or it says, well, I am this body, mind, sense organs person with such and such experiences. So immediately, this is exactly the non-Eva, becoming many, right? Because immediately the consciousness, we're just going to kind of identify it by those things that are conscious, all the upadis, all the conditioning adjuncts. So, well, this body is conscious, my mind is conscious, and all these. So what we have to do, this is very important, that's all true. When you say this body is conscious, that is true. Sense organs are conscious, that's true. The mind is conscious, yes. The I thought is conscious, yes. The emotions, all mind, body, all conscious, yes. Now we know. Now let's just stay with that consciousness. And now let's peel off it all of the dresses. The consciousness is right, yes. This body is conscious, sense organs are conscious, mind is conscious, perfect. But now let's peel off all of the objectifiables, right? Keep the consciousness, but the body isn't objectifiable. You're aware of your body, right? So keep the same consciousness, but now let the body be a dress as though, an upadi. Keep the consciousness, but recognize that the sense organs are also known. You know if you see well, you know if you hear well or don't hear, if you're deaf, or if you have a sense of touch or you don't. These are all objectifiables. Keep the consciousness. Keep the me. You keep the me. If you say, I am this body, right, keep the I am. I am. And recognize then what we can peel off it, the objectifiables. Mind. Moods. All of the thoughts in the mind. Changing. Objectifiables. Keep the self. Take away what I have superimposed on it. So, I mean, there's no distance. Yourself is yourself. There's no false self here. There's no second self. There's no little self. It's the real self. You are the real self. You are the big self, the capital S self. There's no other self. It's just this capital S self, which is Brahman, has, because of ignorance, because of the mind, because of ignorance, has superimposed itself on this capital S self. So that's what this knowledge is. The knowledge is that you, the one that you take to be this body, you are Brahman, not somebody else, not something stuck inside somewhere. It's that the very you that you've taken to be this body, the you that is, taken to be all of the thoughts, that you has to be recognized. That is the you that we're talking about, not any other you. That you is the very one from whom this whole creation has come. Just like the dream. Just like the dream has come and goes. So this is what we have. We have to get rid of this distance, or this big self, little self, and recognize that it is this me that is Brahman. This very me. We have to remove from it anything objectifiable, anything changing, right? Anything that can be an object, anything that exists within duality, anything that comes and goes, any experience that comes and goes. No, that's not it. Even happy experience is not it. Not it. If it can go, it's not you. Your ananda is much greater than any relative ananda. Your ananda is the very fullness of your being. And it's that one that needs to be recognized. Now, who's going to recognize it? Well, in light of this teaching, who will recognize it? One who has the shuddha chetaha. What does that mean? The mind is at peace enough that there is a relative shanti there, so that mind is available to recognize. A mind that doesn't have the vairagya, still has, a relative degree of dispassion, but still has raga dveshas, all of the likes and dislikes, all of the desires. Then what happens? As it's sitting, And the teacher's yapping away, unfolding. So beautifully. So beautifully. Beautifully unfolding. But the mind has 100 things to think about. 100 desires to fulfill. 100 problems to solve. You know? Issues that must be taken care of. Right? And so that mind's just simply not available to recognize the obvious. We're talking about a recognition of the obvious. But to recognize the obvious, the mind has to be available for that. And it's that what makes it not obvious. The self is the most obvious. There's nothing more obvious. But the busy and distracted mind, right, is not available to recognize or to even want to recognize that obvious fact. That's why he says this, Shuddha Chetaha. And the Bhāṣya Shankara says, you know, free from these raga dveshas, the one whose mind can just, that means there's a certain amount of viveka, discrimination, and vairagya. You've already seen, the mind has already seen there's a problem here. That these, all of this, these things in the world, including my body, my mind, my sense organs, all of the, every person, everything, every good thing, every bad thing, everything is anicca. Everything is changing. When that's the situation, that's a sorry state of affairs. Because I can't rely on any on gaining anything constant. I can't rely on becoming anything stable or anything constant or achieving a constant state of mind. It's not even possible if that achievement is based upon those things that are changing. Even as a Jivan Mukta, somebody who has self-knowledge, if they were to think, that's not self-knowledge, but so anyway, if a person were to think that liberation was the achievement of a state of mind, that is not liberation. There is no achievement of a state of mind that is free from change, because the mind by nature changes. So how are you going to achieve a particular state of mind? It's like asking for the camera to have a freeze frame. You know? So the mind is going to stay the mind. But liberation, really, is the recognition, then, not of what is by nature not liberated. It's the recognition of what is by nature liberated. So liberation is the recognition that you are liberated. Of the being that you are, that is liberated. And that is very nice for the mind. The mind relaxes in that. And that's a great pola, a great result for the mind. Because now it can go on changing and thinking and feeling and participating in the world. All the while having a self which is whole and complete. And so for the mind, the problem is over. But it's not because the mind has recognized, I am nitya, I am free from change, I am constant, I am a particular type of experience. No. It's recognized that the me, the being, the who I am, the one who is there, present, always, is Satchitananda. That my being is whole and complete, no matter what the thought. So the mind knows, itself knows, oh, no matter what I'm thinking, it is thinking, it is feeling in the presence of me. Right? Its thoughts are, whatever the thoughts are, whatever the feelings are, whatever the moods are, the emotions are, those moods are in the presence of me. And I am whole. Right? So that's a huge release for the mind. And that stops the mind once it recognizes that the wholeness that it seeks. I'm jumping for a lot of you that are new. You're going to have to make some jumps here. but recognizes that the wholeness, right, the wholeness that it sought, is the self. The wholeness that it sought has never been away from itself. And so the mind relaxes. And that's a wonderful thing for the mind. So it enjoys a sense of peace and happiness that it didn't have before. But it's not a sense of peace or happiness that says, oh, what kind of thought am I going to have next? Whatever thought it has next doesn't matter. Right? The one that's not changing is the self. And so that's where the devotion of the mind is. So the mind is devoted to the changeless being of myself. And then from that vantage point, it lives and experiences the world based upon the prarabdha, the karmas that brought you here. Okay, so let's just take a minute. Om Purnamidah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamidachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. For those of you who are a little new, I'm starting at this point to connect great big things. So as time goes on, I'll go around and fill in all of the logics that you may feel that you're missing. But that's what I'm going to be doing for a while now, is pulling big pieces together for people who have been listening for a while. And then I will still go back and do individual segments of developing the vision. So.
Your Honor, I have a very funny thing going on. I'm sitting here, and a couple of classes have been like that where you unfold consciousness.
Yeah.
And then I could almost say, like, intuitively I understand what consciousness is. And I know you have a problem with that word, I think, intuitive. But the understanding of do I recognize my consciousness and never recognize it for myself is really so. You know? It's really weird. Am I accepting that I know what consciousness is because of what you say? Or because of my own understanding, you know what I mean? I know it sounds crazy.
No, I don't think that's crazy. I think that's why when we go through all of the different teaching methodologies, like see or seen, when we do that very thoroughly and then go to waking, dream, deep, there's different teaching methodologies that are meant to make your mind go step by step by step inwardly, in a sense, in terms of your experience, right? Because here you are, a conscious being, right? So if you can say, yes, I'm a conscious being.
Yeah, I'm not even sure about that, because like that I also got stuck with the word sentience and insentience. So, I mean, maybe it's because I don't understand that word. One means a life force and one means no life force.
Well, like, you wouldn't say that this table is conscious of anything. At least from our vantage point.
Right.
The rug's not. Move. Yeah, it's inert. Yeah, it's not conscious. Doesn't have sense organs.
Oh, okay.
Okay? Doesn't have a mind. So you have sense organs. You can perceive things. You can know things. Even if we sit in meditation, for instance, and I ask you just to kind of relax and be aware of your thoughts, be aware of the sounds outside, right? So you just relax your body and that's okay. Be aware of all of the sensations, the sounds outside. Be aware of your physical body. You are. Because I'm describing an experience, and you are having that experience. Right?
Yeah, right.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, so now I'm saying, I'm saying, when I say be aware of,
right.
Okay, you're aware of all of these things, and then I ask you to go back and forth between just you, the awareful being, and the objects that you're aware of. Like, for instance, you're aware of the traffic sound. Okay, so now I want you to notice the awareness versus the sound that comes and goes. You're aware of, as you're sitting in meditative pose, you're aware of the physical body, and I ask you to relax the physical body. Okay? So, yes, you're aware of that. You could say, yes, I'm aware of it. It's known to me. So now I ask you, all right, differentiate the perception of the body through the sense of touch and the relaxation from your presence, the you that's aware of it. Right? Because you're aware of all of the sensation. So try to separate the sensation of what you're aware of from that which, from the awareness itself. Let's say I go inward. And I also say, okay, now there you are. You are breathing. In and out, going breath. Follow your breath. And I ask you to differentiate between you, the awareful being, and the breath. Right? And this is all we're just trying to hone in on what is awareness and what I'm aware of. Okay. Then we go from there. We go into the mind, and I say, all right, relax your mind and just, you know, be aware of your thoughts. You have one thought and then another, and you might be multiprocessing, so yes, you're aware of all of those thoughts. Right?
Yeah.
And so now I'm asking you to differentiate between yourself, the awareful being, and the thoughts that are coming and going. Because the thoughts go, right? One thought comes and it goes, but you remain conscious. The conscious me remains. So that's why I can even say I had that thought and then I had that thought. That thought came and then that thought. Well, there's somebody there who's constant. So now all this while, all we're doing is honing in on your you, the one that is always there amidst these changing perceptions.
And if I'm aware.
Hmm?
I mean, there's times when I'm not aware that I'm always
well,
something is unchanging, you know?
No, that's true. We're not always aware of it at all, yeah. Because the mind is so used to taking the constant for granted. Right? What is like this? Say you have two thoughts, one and two. The substance of both thoughts is only one awareness, okay? So between the substance of the thought, there's nothing to differentiate between the two, because there's only one substance. But this thought is different than this thought, right? This thought is a cup, and this thought is of a rope, or something like that. Two different thoughts. So I can easily, we're used to differentiating between the changing names and forms of the thoughts, not the substance, which isn't changing at all. So that changelessness is totally taken for granted by the mind, because the mind is only focusing on what changes, right? Because the self, the consciousness, is never changing in any way. So the mind's only focused on the changing. Now what we have to do is, instead of the mind, you know, talking to itself and all of it relating to the changing forms, we now have to make the mind differentiate these changing forms from the changeless being that is always present and pervasive to the changing forms, which the mind is not used to doing. It's only used to looking at what changes.
And could you call that a substratum?
Yeah.
And that's probably why I get confused, why I keep calling it intuition, because like it's more
Well, it's not a form.
Is that a form?
Yeah, your being is not a form, but it's always present as the very conscious being. And so it's this being, me, this me that's always there no matter what the changing thoughts are, that the teaching is keeps pointing at, so you can recognize, oh my gosh, I'm not changing. I am always the same. That was just taken for granted as being one with the mind. The changeless presence of the mind, the non-differentiated presence of the mind, I recognize is actually its own being. And that these changing names and forms, right, don't disturb me. So all of these teachings are keep trying to point out yourself amidst.
Yeah, and then to me that seems though that the awareness, that consciousness has some sort of quality to it though.
Well,
so it's almost like I want to say, well, we're going to be keep recognizing the non-changing, that which is always non-changing, and then that will.
Well, by what we mean,
more and bigger, you see, no, and now I'm kind of conform with itself.
Well, it doesn't become more or bigger. It's just that your mind recognizes it. It's not big or small. It's in fact limitless. It doesn't have one. Once you start recognizing your own presence, you say, "Well, am I big? Am I small? Am I white? Am I black? Am I yellow?" What these words don't apply to your presence. You can't say you're big or small or little or anything like that. Your being is really just your being. And you can say, well, it seems to have a quality. Well, what quality? It has, but quality usually is a word that we use as an attribute to a substantive. On the other hand, awareness or being itself is its own quality. It's not nothing, it's just not a quality of a substantive, but it awareness is awareness. The me is the me. But the only one that can know what those words mean is yourself, because me is not, the self is not an object.
It's almost like I want to say it's happiness.
It is happiness, but not a happiness that comes and goes.
Uncaused happiness.
Yeah, or happiness, or uncaused happiness, or love, or wholeness, or completeness. But all of these words, peace, all of these words that we use and juxtapose one against the other, are not the same as, they don't have the same meaning exactly as when we use them in the world. Because say if you say, happiness in terms of a state of mind. Well, it could be more happiness, or it could be less happiness, or wholeness in terms of an experience. And so we use these words as lakshanas, really, to point to your own changeless self-experience.
That was beautiful.
Yeah, because it is. It's really profound.
Carol, can I ask something? Because I was actually going to ask, is this changeless self, you pretty much just answered it, that it's non, there's no attributes that can be used to describe it, right?
Well, what attribute means is a quality of a substantive, so that there's duality implied that there's a substantive,
right.
And then there's, yeah.
The black shirt or something,
Yeah.
So this changeless self is not amenable to that kind of definition, like you can't define it that way. But then one thing that I've been thinking about lately is, so you have this changeless self, and then you have potentially the vritti of yourself being changeless, like you get exposed to this knowledge and you might be struggling with what this changeless self is.
Yeah.
So you have this chitta vritti of what you think the self is.
No, not quite. Go ahead. Keep going there.
So I guess what I've been struggling with is, so you have this changeless self, and then you have, in some cases, if you're a mumukshu who's searching,
yeah,
you have this chittavritti of, because I keep coming back to, like, what's the word I'm looking for? I understand what the teaching is saying, mm-hmm, but sometimes I don't know if I know the teaching.
Yeah, because what you're saying there is, this is the problem. You're saying the chittavritti, the mind, has a vritti of what the self is. But the way I'm hearing you say that, it's more like an intellection.
Yeah.
Like you were to read a book.
Right.
That's indirect knowledge. That's not direct knowledge. But now, so think of it like this. Somebody says to you, gives a teaching, your nature is infinite. You, in fact, are Brahman. Now you're having a chittavritti that says, oh, you know, the Upanishads say that myself is infinite, that my nature is Brahman. That's an intellectual knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
That, and then you say, gee, I wonder if that's true. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Give me some more logic to show me why that might be true. So now we're just all in the field of intellection.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. However, when we're working with the Upanishads as a means of knowledge, mm-hmm, and we're using a teaching methodology, the mind at that time has a direct, immediate cognition. It's called aparoksha jnanam, an immediate cognition, where it recognizes itself differentiated from the consciousness, which is its changeless being. And so that is not an intellection. That's not a saying, oh, the Upanishads say such and such. That's the Upanishads have been being utilized to take the mind to that recognition. Now, the thing is, consciousness, who you are, is not away from the mind in order to have an indirect knowledge. Not that you can't have an indirect knowledge, because you could be reading the Upanishads and say, oh, isn't that interesting? This is what the Upanishads, but you have no idea what they're talking about. But if the Upanishads are being used as a teaching methodology, then they are taking your mind, right, which we're trying to do in this class. I'm not trying to use this. I'm not teaching this as an intellectual exercise. I'm trying to teach it in a way that your mind is following what I'm saying, the words,
mm-hmm,
so that those words are resolving into the reality.
Mm.
Because there's no separation from between yourself and your mind. You are here. Your mind is here. The teaching is here. There's no reason not to have a direct, immediate knowledge of it. That pramana's got to work. You know?
So do you have any suggestions for people that that intellectualize this?
Yeah. The suggestion is for you to ask questions like this and for you to answer them and,
mm-hmm,
and ask all of these kinds of questions until your mind is just becomes attuned to listening in that way.
Because mm-hmm, I find that the my understanding of this is that the mind is so mercurial that it assumes it's like...
It's sneaky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Swamiji often, he used to use the example of Vedanta, the Upanishads, being like a big flashlight, a big beam of light that's just following the ego around. Yeah, it's scrambling for a little dark corner to hide in, you know, and then here it comes, and then you see this kind of, and it goes someplace else. But at some point, there's no place for that ego to go, and it just gives up. Goes, okay.
Could I ask one more thing from a psychological perspective? Is so yourself is changing, and it's not.
What
yet,
self is changing?
I mean, it's not changing.
Yeah.
Sorry, Freudian slip. and it's not. You can't attach an attribute to it, and with a thought, like with a...
Well, I want to clear something. When you say you can't attach an attribute to it, sometimes when I hear you say that...
Yeah, I need to be careful.
It makes me think that you're saying that there's no self-experience as your own being there.
Yeah, so, I'm not saying
okay,
that.
Okay, good.
But a thought, you know, just a thought, you know, if you were scientifically to try to say what is a thought, I mean, can you really do that? Can you attach any kind of attribute to a...
Well, we can describe a thought so that everybody can recognize it, but you're right in the sense of you want to say, well, what is a thought? Just like I could say, like, well, what is a lamp? It's mitya, and so it's infinitely divisible, and you'll never find anything there. However, in the relative reality, vyavaharika, the reality that we experience, we can describe it. And that's what the Vedanta does. It describes it so that we can use that description for you to recognize it and then differentiate it. And we can say very important things about the nature of the thought that you're experiencing.
But unlike the lamp, which I can touch.
It doesn't matter. The thought, the lamp, you can touch and perceive through your sense organs, but the thought, the thought is something that's what we call sakshibhasyam. It's recognized,
mm-hmm.
right? Because awareness illumines it. And so it's there to be described.
Okay.
And it can, there's a generic, if I could say, description that we can also yet say, yes, that's the nature of a thought. Like, it's something that I'm aware of. It's subtle. It's something that is always changing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can talk about the types of thoughts like the Vedanta does. Or, well, there's memory, citta. And there's the manas, the fluctuating mind, and the buddhi, the intellection, or the decisive thinking, the ahankara, the I notion. So I can describe them. There's perceptions. All that's all we need. We just need to be able to describe them, talk about their nature, so that we can differentiate them from the self and show the order of reality that they enjoy. It doesn't really matter what they are. That's enough for our purposes.
But like the hand is the sense organ that touch allows me to touch this. It's the mind that is the sense organ that is perceiving thoughts.
Well, we don't say like that. The mind creates a vritti, a thought modification,
mm-hmm.
either through perception, right, through the sense organs, or it has certain types of vrittis it can create on its own, like memory, imagination, thinking, the ahankara. So these vrittis are what the mind is capable of having, the variety of different types of vrittis. Those vrittis are illumined by awareness. It's not that awareness is a knower, but the vrittis are known. Awareness from its own standpoint is not a knower. But the vrittis are known because of the awareness. It's not that the vrittis know the vrittis as though the vrittis have some little secret awareness stuck in there. The vrittis are known because of the sakshi, because of the awareness. Kind of see? Good.
Can I ask something?
No, sure.
The thing that keeps bothering me is that if the buddhi only derives its sentience from consciousness, how is the buddhi able to do anything independently, such as posits that it is separate?
It never does anything independently because the buddhi is never away from consciousness. That doesn't hurt. That doesn't make any difference at all whether the buddhi, which is enjoying the consciousness of the atma, whether it says, I am separate from consciousness, or I am consciousness, doesn't change that fact. One is a true statement, one is a false statement. In any case, consciousness is changeless. The buddhi can say anything it wants. It doesn't make any difference in terms of the consciousness.
But how does it say anything? I mean, basically, it's not even a living thing apart from consciousness, right?
But because it's not apart from consciousness, you say it's not a living thing apart from consciousness, but since it's not apart from consciousness, since it enjoys consciousness,
mm-hmm.
Why is that a problem? The body's not a living thing either. The best body is when the soul leaves the body. Say, forget the consciousness. When the soul leaves the body, this body's dead.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But it's a living thing now.
If right? The body doesn't set up its separation from the one consciousness, whereas buddhi, for some reason, sets it up, even though it only derives its even ability to say anything like that from consciousness.
Yeah, but I don't understand why that's a problem, because, say, the buddhi, enjoying consciousness, can recognize that it is known. Like I was telling Peter, if you're sitting watching your thoughts coming and going, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like especially powerful if you do japa's, very good for that. So you watch the thoughts coming and going, and also it's very clear that your being is constant. Okay. Now, if I were to be leading the meditation, I would say, do you notice that your being is constant and the thoughts are moving? The mind would say, yes, I recognize that. But it's talking when it says, yes, I recognize that. It is recognizing that the buddhi, that the mind is changing, you know, and that the self is not. And it is commenting on that. Why can't it comment on whatever reality is apparent to it?
Okay. Even a mistaken reality.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It doesn't matter.
Okay.
With ignorance or knowledge, it's still commenting away.
Well, that's like saying nothing can touch the self. Right.
Right.
No,
it makes no difference.
Water,
it could say I'm a monkey.
Yeah.
Or it could say I'm Satchitananda. One's true, one isn't.
Yeah.